And welcome back. You're listening to No One Is Legal Radio, part of the Open Conspiracy for Social Change on Off the Hour. We're at 90.3 FM in Montreal and at www.ckut.ca on the web. Later this week, as a part of Culture Shock, Biju Matthew, a labor organizer in New York City, will be speaking on two events. This Thursday, Biju will be on a panel as a part of an event entitled The City is a Sweatshop, Migration, Work, and Resistance. The event will take place at the Samuel Bromfont Building at 1590 Dr. Penfield Avenue, which is at the corner of Côte des Neiges, at 7 p.m. Other panelists include Sarita Ahuja of the Migrant Workers Support Center and No One Is Illegal, and Samail Behouli of the Action Committee of Non-Status Algerians and Solidarity Across Borders. As well, this Friday, Biju will be speaking about saffron dollars, how North Americans fund genocide in India. That event takes place on the McGill campus in Shatner 302, which is at 3480 McTavish Street at 4 p.m. Biju Matthew is originally from Hyderabad, India. For the past decade, he's been an organizer with the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, which represents thousands of New York City's predominantly immigrant taxi drivers. He is also the author of Taxi, Cabs and Capitalism in New York City. Biju was interviewed at length this weekend by No One Is Illegal Montreal collective member Jaggi Singh. On today's show, we play a short excerpt with Biju's reflections on day-to-day organizing with the Taxi Workers Alliance, as well as the politics of race in New York City.
Biju, we've talked a little bit about the macro level of organizing within the Taxi Workers Alliance, but I want you to talk now a little bit about the micro level, that is the day-to-day organizing that you do and how that looks and how that feels. I remember being in New York, being at a 24-hour Indian restaurant and seeing you walk in, leaving a stack of papers, seeing a lot of drivers hanging around. So give us a sense. I know a lot of this is in your book, Taxi, Cabs, and Capitalism in New York City, but give a sense to our listeners of that micro level of organizing, that day-to-day and night-to-night, I guess, of organizing with taxi drivers. How does that look? How does that feel?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you said day-to-day and then also switched to night-to-night, because I think, you know, it's in those micros that a lot of things lies. I mean, one of the things about taxi driving in New York City and possibly in every other big city in North America, one of the things that we probably should note is that drivers do really long shifts, 12-hour shifts, and that really doesn't leave them much time outside of their work time, doesn't leave them much time of leisure. I always say that leisure in the taxi industry is a constantly postponed activity where, you know, you, because it's an immigrant workforce and they are dealing with industry like the taxi industry, and they're also dealing with displacements, etc., of various varieties. Leisure is something that you hope to get to when you go back home for a visit. Let's say once every 2 years, once every year, once every 3 years, you go back home for 6 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, and that's your moment of leisure. Now, all of this assumes that they have, quote-unquote, the necessary paperwork to be able to travel. So, but coming back to the organizing itself, when one is faced with a workforce that almost has no leisure, how does one organize that kind of a workforce? How does one produce the structures that are required for engagement, because organizing is all about engagement at several levels. Several things I'll say. One is that the organizing then comes out of a really systematic and very deep level understanding of daily lives. And what I mean by that is, for instance, in the case of New York City, there's a concept called shift change, wherein every day drivers hand cars over to their partners at a specific spot in the city. Most often it is at one of the gas stations in Manhattan, because the night partner can come into the city and get the cab and jump into business straight away, because the shift change in the evening happens during rush hour. And so one of the spots where organizing can potentially happen is at these shift changes, where around 40 to 50% of the drivers exchange their car in Manhattan itself at one of the gas stations. So the night driver who's going to take over comes into the gas station and is waiting around there for probably anywhere from 10 to 20 minutes before his day partner shows up. So that becomes a moment of engagement. So also, the day partner, having handed the car over, though he is dog tired at that point in time, has potentially a brief window of time to talk, etc., with organizers. In that kind of a context, you can imagine an organization like the Taxi Workers Alliance, especially now faced when we are just setting out to do the work, showing up at these spaces and what that meant. I mean, I always say that organizing is so much about habit and so much about being part of the what I call the furniture, in the sense that, you know, I can say with a clarity of, you know, a memory that the first several times that I showed up at a particular shift change, nobody would even look at me. And they didn't have a good reason to look at me, because here I was coming around with a flyer, with a pamphlet. And one of the things about immigrant workers we must realize is that they come into the U.S. or Canada or any space in the West with a significant amount of political experience, in the sense that most of them have really strong memories, if not actual participation in national liberation movements. They have at least lived through the initial period of the first 20 or 30 years after a national liberation struggle in several parts of the Third World, and the first 20 or 30 years post national liberation struggle is always a very contentious time, wherein all sorts of organizations are emerging in civil society, various classes and other kinds of groupings are positioning themselves, and the struggle to make a nation into one thing or the other is going on. So people come in with a tremendous amount of political experience, and often cynical, because several of those political experiences, let's face it, in the Third World, haven't quite turned out right for the workers or for the poor. And so in that context, there's a tremendous amount of cynicism about what the possibilities of politics are. So here's a guy wearing, you know, cargo jeans and a T-shirt, showing up and distributing flyers. They know he looks similar to you, but they also know immediately that he is different from you. And so the question is, what kind of a relationship can you have? And my answer to that was very simple then, and my answer remains the same today, which is that if you want to take organizing seriously, you just stay there. You just become part of the furniture. 2 months, if you show up regularly for 2 months or 3 months, sooner than later, they will have no choice but to take you seriously, in the sense of saying, dang, this guy is not going away. I mean, he's become part of the space. And in that sense, they have to begin to deal with you. And moment those first few conversations happen after that reconciliation, I think the whole relationship changes. And, you know, the issue of trust begins to build up from there on. So I think it's just that kind of investment in the early part of the project. Yesterday in the afternoon, I was at the taxi holding lot in LaGuardia Airport for 4.5 hours, basically doing outreach with the drivers. That's another spot where we meet our membership and mass base now for long stretches of time, because we can go to the airport holding lots, and that's the place where drivers are stuck, so to speak, for several hours at a time. Sometimes it's just half hour, sometimes it's as long as the wait, sometimes it's as long as 2 hours. And so you have space and time for engagement. So I was there for 4.5 hours. We're in the middle of a really intense campaign right now around the installation of global positioning system software and equipment, hardware, into the taxis. And we are quite determined to beat that. We're quite determined to ensure that nothing called a GPS ever enters a New York City taxi cab. And so that fight is going on. The city, actually, its timeline for introducing that was by early 2005. So we've already delayed it by a year and a half, and we are very sure we'll delay it by another year and a half, and in the process of delaying it by another year and a half, kill the project from the city end. And I was thinking of yesterday, because while I was at the airport yesterday, I think what is if I reflect on the 4 hours that I spent in the airport yesterday with, let's say, something from 1998, 1999, when I began to go to the airport holding lots, I think the important difference is, you know, you get there are visual markers to the difference in the sense that in 1998 I could have spent 3 hours or 4 hours in the holding lot, and then at the end, as I started walking from one end of the holding lot to the exit, and if I just did a visual examination of the space around me, I could see, I could have a testament to how effective I was, or how much the drivers trust us, how many of the drivers take us seriously, by just the number of abandoned flyers on the ground, on the floor of the lot. Whereas yesterday, for instance, I know for a fact that as I was walking out, there was not a single one of our flyers that was abandoned on the floor. No, every one of those had been taken by the drivers. Second is what happens in a space like that. Earlier on, you would have to go from driver to driver to driver to driver, speaking to them individually, occasionally in small groups of two or three. But yesterday for me, for instance, I really didn't have to do any of that. All I did was position myself near the canteen, near where the food stall is, and large groups of drivers would come up to me, and we would all, around groups of 20 or 30 at one shot, would have conversations about what our plans and strategies were to fight the GPS, right? So I think those are all the changes. And I think, again, the fundamental rule for me is become part of the furniture, be there, and just consistently build that relationship. And the other part then is that you need assessments of various variety, and you need to be doing this in a way wherein you actually, organizing in the end, and mass organizing most specifically in the end, is about understanding where a community is at a particular moment, what are the structures of its disempowerment, and taking them to a new place wherein they have a sense of power. And it is precisely the sense of power that makes it possible for them to do new things, do more things. So it's a whole bunch of adjustments in terms of, as I said, understanding the precise structure of their daily lives. So while I said, for instance, that leisure was a constantly postponed activity, for night drivers, there is a little more leisure than day drivers, right, in the sense that a night driver starts a shift out at 5 o'clock in the evening and doesn't quite end technically till 5 the next morning. But oftentimes, let's say on a Monday night or a Tuesday night or even a Wednesday night, there is really no business on the street after around 1 o'clock in the night or 2 o'clock in the night. And so even if you stay out on the street between 1 and 4, you're probably going to make $20. Now, that's a window where a driver will potentially give up that time and say, all right, I'm just going to make $10 or $15 or $20. I might as well go for a union meeting. Right, so a lot of our meetings, and so we built up our night membership base a lot better than our day membership base one. And so a lot of our meetings, for instance, happen at 2 o'clock in the night, and that's the best time for a meeting. Almost all of our meetings aimed at our night driver membership happen between 2 and 4 in the night. Right, so it's trying to understand where the community is, trying to understand where people are located, how their work lives are structured, how the rest of their lives are structured, and then building all of that together. There are so many experiments we've done. For instance, I mean, when I said leisure is a constantly postponed activity and people go home for these three, four, 6 week stretches, we, for instance, explored the possibility of setting up a kind of an office and an organizing space back in the Punjab in India and Pakistan or even in Bangladesh, right? Because if our membership is going back and are going to have 2 or 3 months of relatively free time in those spaces, why don't we try organizing there? It's not that as if that project took off, that sub-project took off and reached any level of fruition, but it's also not something we didn't explore. I mean, several of us went on exploratory trips to India and Pakistan, Punjab, to actually see whether we could pull something like that off.
that sort of reflects on my next question, which was about race, and race in the American context, I think, is both simple and complex. It's simple in the sense that America is a very racist society, but there's layers of complexity to that. And I'm just wondering if you could address that vis-a-vis the organizing with the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, both in terms of internal challenges, because just superficially, I guess, from my perspective, both from as someone living in Toronto and in Montreal, it seems to me that there's a lot of divisions based on cultural origin that might be a huge impediment to organizing. In Montreal, for example, there's a large group of Haitian drivers, and they seem to be at odds with other groups of drivers. Again, that's a superficial observation. But secondly, I guess one of the ways in which progressives look at cabbies is the whole issue of blacks trying to get fares in New York City. And that's, of course, been a huge issue. And I know one that you've addressed. So I'm wondering if you can address, and I know it's a hugely complex issue, but if you can address both aspects of that race politics.
Sure. Now, I think the internal part is much, much easier to deal with. And because there are some very simple caveats that we've operated through. One is that there is nothing called simple cultural difference based on national origin. In as much as, you know, we all know that several of us, meaning several people all across the world, live cosmopolitan lives, for lack of a better word, wherein we really do know, we really do find ways of relating to other cultures and bringing that into our lives in ways, getting knocked around by those cultures a little bit, not knowing our roadmaps through it on occasion, but also knowing how to negotiate that lack of knowledge and all of that. So it's not rocket science to produce those relationships in spite of absolutely different cultures, which then translates to the next corollary, which is that when in specific industries or when in specific urban spaces there is, quote-unquote, strife or tension between any set of communities, it is both based in specific histories of those communities, which may go back into their national origins, but is also significantly based on what's happening on the ground within that space there, that urban space there. And what I mean by that is, for instance, in the case of the New York City taxi industry, one of the most obvious relationships of tension that one could potentially have predicted could have been between Indian and Pakistani drivers. Because, when I said that May 13th, 1998 was the strike, May 11th or so, I think, or May 6th or something like that, was when the Indian nuclear test went off. And 2 weeks after the May 13th strike was when the Pakistani response nuclear test went off. So you can imagine the level of tension back in South Asia at that moment between the two countries. But it's also a moment when the Indian and the Pakistani drivers held together in New York City. And I still remember several of the press people coming into our strike headquarters and asking precisely this question of Indian or Pakistani drivers. And I was not at all surprised at some level by their reaction. You know, literally all of them said, you know what, it doesn't really matter to us. We are here on the ground and we are treated the same by let's say, an NYPD cop. So at that level, it's the commonality of the work experience is, of course, a fundamental building block of these relationships. But I think what is also important to realize is that the way to build these relationships up is to ensure that all of the reasons for the strife are brought out into the open and spoken about. So, for instance, between the Indian and the Pakistani drivers, one of our policies has always been that all these questions of nationalism, which several unions, I know deal with as this is extraneous to the work issues that we're dealing with, and therefore we don't need to talk about it. We, on the other hand, take the exact opposite tack, wherein we have full-length discussions as part of our meetings and some of these things. The most interesting tension for us, for instance, which we've negotiated fairly successfully, was not between Indian and Pakistani drivers, but between Pakistani and Bangladeshi drivers, because that national history of liberation struggle in Bangladesh was much more recent one, and therefore the injuries were far more available for memory, because several of the drivers from Bangladesh were people who participated in the national liberation struggle, who had lost family during the national liberation struggle, immediate family. And so that was the tension. And second, for the fact that most of the Pakistani members and really didn't have a real good sense of what the hell the Pakistani army did in Bangladesh for those 4 years. So that was a really, really tense thing to negotiate. But it was done by openly talking about it in several of our early meetings, wherein we'd actually talk about what national liberation is about, what that struggle in Bangladesh meant, et cetera, et cetera. And there are several members of the union right now, Pakistanis, who actually come around and say that without the Taxi Workers Alliance and the kind of conversations we had in there, we would never really have known what the Pakistan government did in what was then East Pakistan and then later became Bangladesh. So I think that's one. But, but you know, when you specifically speak about other communities like which don't share that past, for instance, immediately after the Taxi Workers Alliance was formed, just a little before the strikes happened, the ownership decided to get smart and set up a proxy union, an in-house union, to challenge us. And what they and the way they produced it was by gathering in the taxi industry in New York City, the centerpiece for all understanding the taxi industry is the medallion. The medallion is a high-value thing that's a permit to put one yellow taxi on the street. Right now, its open market value is around $450,000 for one medallion. But during the period of the strike, it was around $300,000. Now, the point is simple, that what they did was there is a small layer around 10% of the industry where it is individual owner drivers, that is individuals who own their own medallion. And as you can potentially imagine, the people who are that 10% are people who've stayed in the industry for a long stretch. Those who came into the industry in the early 80s, mid 80s, etc., when the medallion values were still relatively low compared to the contemporary figures. And that meant that a lot of the drivers who were in that owner-driver category in the late 90s and even now were Haitian drivers who had come into the industry in the early 80s. And Sikh drivers, Sardar drivers, who came into the industry in the mid-80s. And so the ownership got a bunch of these owner drivers together, primarily Sikhs and some Haitians, and pulled them together into a union and put them up as a union that was challenging us and broke the mass base down along ethnic lines. Very, very few Sardars and very, very few Haitians joined the Taxi Workers Alliance initially. Now, what I'm pointing to there is how both the class character, internal class characteristics of or class aspirations of the workforce itself begins to play a role, and how structures like the larger ownership, which is the garages, the big garages, the big brokers, etc., attempted to use those aspirations in particular ways to create what seems like an ethnic division. It's a perfectly secular division in real terms because it's based on class aspirations. But when one looks at it from another point of view, it only appears as ethnic division. Oh, the Taxi Workers Alliance does not have any Sardar membership. Oh, the Taxi Workers Alliance does not have any Haitian membership. Right? Now, how did we deal with it? We dealt with it on the basis of what that union was trying to do. And we broke that union down, in the sense that it struggled along for around a year and a half and then fell apart based on its own contradictions. And then over the next 3 years or 4 years, we took tremendous care to build a relationship with the Sikh and the Haitian community and brought them back into the union. And so now, I mean, the Taxi Workers Alliance has all of these people who are part of the mass base and the membership in a full and significant way. Sorry. So that's as far as the internal politics goes. On external politics of race, yes, it is true that there is this problem of discrimination on the street that several drivers indulge in when faced with certain customers. Now, one of the things about that is that every single driver knows that that's something wrong, that is not to be done, right? And so very, very early on, just like our philosophy with internal ethnic divisions, we decided to take that on head on rather than, you know, not take it on, rather than push it and hide it under the carpet. But the problem there was that it was the very difficult thing to get a conversation going on. We could go to the airports and the holding lots with material just on race and try and talk to the drivers, and immediately a wall would come up because they all knew that there was something dramatically wrong with what was being done. But also, we're doing it for all sorts of reasons, and the only defensive reaction available to them was to put up a wall immediately and not talk about it. Now, there was an incident in New York City in 1999, which became high profile, when Danny Glover, the famous Hollywood actor, tried to hail a cab uptown and was passed by several cabs and did not get a cab immediately. Now, obviously, and for good reason, the man was livid, and when he did finally manage to hail a cab down, he got into it and he picked up a fight with the driver because he was livid. Now, the driver did, in reasonable terms, try and explain to Glover that, man, I'm not the person you should be fighting with because I'm the guy who picked you up. So I was not the guy who was discriminating you, and you should therefore not be having a fight with me. But Glover at that point was not willing to listen to any of that. He kept the fight going, and at one point it became a shouting match between the two of them, and Glover decided to complain about the driver to the Taxi and Limousine Commission. So he went to the TLC, complained about the driver, and having done that as a kind of a purgatory thing, came down, and because Glover himself was a reasonable chap at many levels, fairly liberal, fairly progressive, and so he came down and he realized he had made a mistake, and so he immediately called a press conference, used his entire PR machinery to mobilize the press, and actually publicly and to grant him what the really significant amount of courage that he showed, he stood there on the steps of the TLC, called a press conference, and publicly said, I just made a mistake. I complained about a driver I shouldn't have complained about. And so I'm publicly withdrawing the complaint, but not only that, I think the way to deal with this is by talking to the labor union in the industry. Is there a labor union? I want to reach out to you. And so that's where we came in. And when we came in, again, we had a choice. We could have, mollycoddled Glover and avoided the issue and swept it under the carpet, and the press would have picked something else up in the next 3 or 4 days. The issue would have vanished off the front pages in a matter of a week, and we could have gone scot-free. But instead, we decided to use precisely that moment to try and change the whole thing. And we mounted in the next month and a half a dramatic campaign of race-related education. And because the issue was so high profile, drivers had no choice but to come into conversation on it. And I think that period of 2 months of work really has made a tremendous difference in New York City.
That about wraps it up for this month's edition of No One Is Illegal Radio on Off the Hour, part of CKUT's Open Conspiracy for Social Change. We urge you to get in touch with us about our show with your feedback, comments, critiques, and suggestions. You can reach us by email at noonisillegal@gmail.com or by phone at 514-848-7583. That's 514-848-7583. This month's show is produced and hosted by Layla, Mustafa, Jaggi, and Aisha. The next No One Is Legal Montreal radio show will be on the air live on Tuesday, December 12th from 5 to 6 p.m. In Montreal, tune in at 90.3 FM or listen online at www.ckut.ca. Stay tuned now for our friends from the Native Solidarity News. Thanks again to Ashanti and Bijou for their interviews with No One Is Illegal and for their ongoing inspiration as organizers. Peace out.